Guardian Unlimited.
Well, hello there. I've been expecting you. I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. And if you're listening to this, it's a 110-mile-an-hour scientific fact that you are, on average, 17% better-looking and more intelligent than the rest of the population. Coming up on this week's show, hear me gibbering like a hippie fool as I get well and truly stoned. And it's all in the name of scientific research, I assure you. In other non-drug-related matters, we have Dr. Sandy Knapp from the Natural History Museum to talk about taxonomy and thermometers as we mark the 300th anniversary of Carl Linnaeus' birth. Plus, we find out how Richard Dawkins, Steve Jones and Martin Rees got on in the Guardian Science Experiment at the Hay Festival. And put away your laptop, throw away your desktop. We discuss Microsoft's latest attempt to take over the world. Sorry, I mean the computer world. Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Oh my, look who's here to join me de la pod this week. First up, it's tech correspondent Bobby 2.0 Johnson.
I'm actually 2.1 now. I had a...
You had an upgrade?
Well, no, I just had a rather large Chinese takeaway last night, so I'm a bit larger, yeah.
And making his first appearance since the last one, it's Ian Blood Sample.
Always a good joke, hello.
I'm sure you've never...
Haven't we got a better one? There's got to be something ruder.
Ben tried to make me say the ruder one, but I wouldn't. Anyway.
I can think of several others as well.
We've got Dr. Sandy Knapp as well from Natural History Museum, but we'll hear a bit from her in just a moment. Given your previous form, producer Ben, I'm slightly scared at what you have in store for us in terms of the opening music here. Well, I'm so glad you didn't go for something obvious there, like Bob Marley or, you know, some trippy Beatles track or something. Anyway, okay, that was Weezer, and they're definitely all on drugs. And so was I last week. I rolled up at 11 a.m. On Thursday to the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College, where I was promptly injected with a large dose of THC, which is the main psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. Now, it's all part of an experiment to test the effects of THC on the human brain. Here's Professor Paul Morrison, who's leading the research, preparing me for the experience.
Generally, the THC effect lasts 2 hours, but by an hour, people feel the effects waning off. After about 10 minutes, we start to run some cognitive tests, some memory tests. I'll read out a list of words and ask you to repeat them back, and then we'll test you about 20 minutes after that to see how many of those words you've actually remembered. Several times during it, we'll be putting questionnaires in front of you and asking you to fill out and to note down your experiences. How did it feel? Did you have this effect, that effect? Because this is Institute of Psychiatry, we are particularly interested in the ability of THC to induce psychosis. Now, whether you have psychosis or not, we can't say in advance, but some of the questions might sound quite weird. For instance, do you feel someone's controlling your mind? Can you hear voices? Can you hear your own thoughts out loud, etc., etc.? Generally, people find the effect quite marked, whether they have psychosis or not, and things do feel a bit strange. But if you try and go with it, and keep in the back of your mind that if you want to stop, we could stop.
So as you can imagine, I felt perfectly at ease after all of that. And yeah, although he said, you know, it's only going to last a couple of hours, Ian can attest to the fact that when he met me in a pub at 9 o'clock in the evening, there was definitely still something going on there. Anyway, this is how I got on.
How are you doing? Yeah.
I think something's happening.
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a big grin on my face.
Yeah, I've definitely got a big grin on my face.
It's kind of getting a bit false. It's quite enjoyable.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, now, how can I describe this? There's a kind of warm feeling in my stomach, I guess. And I feel quite lightheaded. Yeah, it feels like, I think I can feel my heart, so yeah, it feels like maybe my heart rate has increased.
Okay. Has the experience changed in intensity?
I sometimes have moments when I think I'm starting to come down, but then they sort of go away again, or I look at something else or something.
Yeah.
I think we've just got one cognitive test to go, actually. Were you enjoying the cognitive test?
Well, I wouldn't say I was enjoying them, though. They required a lot of concentration. I seem to remember on the AB one though, last time there was quite a hardcore time limit.
Yeah.
But you didn't mention it.
You got
to get to the end of it.
You got well within the time. You finished with 30 seconds to go.
Oh, really? Because last time, I think I was right up against the wire, I think, just as I finished.
Oh.
Someone said stop, so which makes me think that those answers aren't that accurate, probably.
We'll see.
I expect, stone people must be really boring to listen to.
They certainly are, and that's the first time I've listened to that since yesterday, and I'm glad to hear that any professional credibility that I may once have had has now entirely evaporated.
Are we assuming that you had some in the first place there, James? I think, you know, proof to everyone that kids in the world of Grange Hill just say no.
Yeah.
But we heard Paul say that he couldn't predict whether you were going to experience any psychosis. We did all kind of chuckle there, I think, at the idea of you suddenly going loopy on us. But did you? What happened?
Well, I think I was quite fortunate. I mean, some of the questions he was asking were things like, is someone controlling your mind? Can you see your thoughts in front of you? Are objects around the room controlling your thoughts? Is this a setup of the experimenters, doing things with your brain, that kind of stuff? I didn't answer yes to any of them because my experience was sort of, 98% pleasurable. I mean, there were kind of slight moments of paranoia, but generally, it was very pleasurable, but he said that, you know, that there's been a great variety of reactions amongst the people there. Some people that he's had in there have been totally paranoid and had, really not a very pleasurable experience at all.
What are they actually trying to achieve by doing it, apart from giving you a good day out?
Well, that was actually the second of two sessions, and one of them they give you the drug, the second one, or the other one, they give you the placebo, and it's a double-blind trial, so neither of you knows for sure, although it was pretty obvious to me. And then they do these cognitive tests, which are quite hard, it's naming as many words as you can, beginning with the same letter, giving you a list of sort of 20 words, getting you to learn them, and then asking you in 20 minutes how many you can remember, trying to kind of remember lists of playing cards and things like that. Really hard stuff. The weird thing was that I actually did better on two of the tests, two out of three tests, when I was on cannabis, which was quite strange. I'm not sure that was what...
We'll try and bring that in as a work policy, then, shall we, to sharpen up all of our attempts at writing. So you said this is a pretty safe environment. There's nothing...
Well, there's a doctor in the room monitoring exactly what's going on the whole time, and if you have a really bad anxiety attack, they've got some drugs there that can essentially sort of bring you down straight away. So, it is a very safe way of doing it. However, we don't want to be kind of glorifying cannabis use here, because there's evidence out there for younger people whose brains are still developing. There's evidence that cannabis can precipitate schizophrenia or schizophrenia-like symptoms, so that's definitely worth saying. What he would say was that in that particular experiment, his subjects are all over 21, so he's, trying to avoid any of that kind of problem.
What are the... We've talked before about, the scaremongering in the press about... super skunk that's a thousand times more powerful than it was 10 years ago. What was the kind of dosage of THC that you were...
Well, I mean, he billed it to me as sort of... It's 2.5 milligrams of THC, which he billed as sort of the amount in a strong joint. But, I mean, it was a very, very intense experience, and I suspect that the reason for that is that, mainlining it is very different than smoking it. What
you're still
kind of,
suffering, aren't you?
I am. I have been slightly slow on the uptake today, I must admit. Yeah. Homo sapiens, Felis catus, Canis familiaris. Human, domestic cat, domestic dog. All names that we have one man to thank for, the Swedish scientist Carl Linnaeus. And although the botanist, doctor and zoologist named some 13,000 animals, his real achievement is the biological naming system itself, the binomial Latin naming system that scientists use the world over. This year marks the 300th anniversary of Linnaeus' birth, and we have with us Dr. Sandy Knapp of the Natural History Museum, who is also Botanical Secretary of the Linnaean Society. Sandy, welcome to the pod. Thanks very much. I am kind of slightly compos mentis now, but...
Excellent.
So why is it so important to name species?
Well, one thing about a name is that if you give anything a name, it means you can talk to other people about it. It's quite difficult to talk to somebody about something that doesn't have a name. You have to kind of circumlocute around it and describe it in excruciating detail. So, well, we just talked about cannabis, and cannabis is a scientific name. The scientific name of marijuana is Cannabis sativa, which is another of those names that Linnaeus gave to things. And so I think naming things is a really important communication tool. I think probably the most important thing about Linnaeus's naming system, you know, we all think it's Latin, so it's really scary. But show me any 5-year-old who doesn't know the name of 5 dinosaurs. You know, all kids know dinosaur names, and those are all Latin scientific names. So where between 6 and 25 did we suddenly get so scared of Latin?
I mean, in the sort of post-Darwin world, the link between Linnaean classification and evolutionary relationships seems quite obvious, but obviously that would have been much more controversial or even not thought of at the time. Did Linnaeus think in that way at all?
No, not at all. I think it's quite easy to look back pre-Darwin, Darwin-Wallace, Origin of Species, and see proto-evolutionary thought. You can see people like Linnaeus. I mean, one of the things Linnaeus did is he put us, Homo sapiens, as part of his category, the primates. So he put us with the great apes.
And that in itself was quite controversial.
Well, it doesn't seem to have been particularly controversial at the time. It was a little bit controversial when Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather, wrote a rather florid poem about all of this. But it doesn't seem to have been particularly controversial, except people sort of disapproved of it because they felt that man shouldn't be classified with monkeys. But what Linnaeus was doing is he was using things you could actually look at. And if you look at human beings and you look at great apes, we have lots and lots of features in common. And so you have those features in common. Linnaeus put this together into his box that was called the primates. We mustn't ever think of it as being evolutionary related in the way we think of it now. But he did recognise those similarities.
I was quite interested in how dynamic this system is now. Is it still really fit for purpose? And is genetics impinging on this very much in terms of either shifting species around or just influencing the way, you know, those names are given?
Definitely is. Genetics in the sense of DNA sequence, as opposed to genetics as in crossing and hybridization, is it's hard to... Naming species and deciding what a species is are two really different things. And I think that what a species is, it's a sort of hypothesis about the distribution of variation in nature. So it's a kind of an idea about we can call this lump of stuff all the same thing. And you, in 10 years' time, when you relook at the groups that I do taxonomy on, might say, well, she was completely bonkers. I mean, well, how could she possibly think those two things were different? These are all the same thing. And it has to do with looking at things with different sets of characters. So Linnaeus, for example, to put things into groups, only counted anthers and ovaries. So he counted male and female parts. Whereas today, we perhaps would look at DNA sequence or pollen or look at leaves or growth habit or all kinds of different characteristics.
And what, apart from, you know, the naming, which is what most people know him for, what other scientific achievements go by his name?
You name it. He was a true Enlightenment man, Linnaeus. He was amazing. He was born, 300 years ago, 1707, you know, very beginning of the 18th century. And he published his first System of Nature when he was 28 years old. So he was out there classifying all of nature at the age of 28, which I think is great, you know. Best ideas come when you're young. And he also invented a 100-degree thermometer, where he had 0 being the boiling point and 100 being the freezing point. To us, that sounds completely mad to have it that way around. But maybe if his thermometer, instead of the centigrade one or the Celsius one, had caught on, we would be thinking that having 0 degrees is freezing and 100 degrees is boiling was completely bonkers. He was the first person to get a banana to bloom in Holland. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, Richard Dawkins, Martin Rees and Steve Jones search for the Enlightenment. But will any of them find it? Plus, Bobby will tell us about a terrifically exciting 7 days on the internet. That's all coming up, but you're going to just have to wait a little bit longer for the best bits, because first, it's time for a roundup of all the other science news that's been making the headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
Scientists have hailed a significant advance in the understanding of breast cancer. They've identified 4 gene variants that increase a woman's chance of developing the disease by up to 60%. Only a small minority of cancers have a genetic component, though, and these genes probably only account for fewer than 200 cases a year out of 44,000.
Our ancestors were not clumsy knuckle-draggers who later straightened their posture, but tree dwellers who gracefully learned to walk on 2 feet in the canopies. The new theory comes from hours of observations of orangutans, who use a bipedal posture to edge out onto precarious branches while keeping their hands free to grab fruit.
A prescription-only pill with a high success rate in helping people quit smoking has become available on the NHS. That's our National Health Service for people outside the UK. The drug called Champix reduces nicotine cravings. In trial, 44% of smokers had quit after 12 weeks of using it, compared with 17% of people on a placebo.
And finally, Sir David Attenborough has said he detects a moral change in the public's attitude to global warming. The veteran natural history filmmaker said he thinks people are starting to understand that using gas-guzzling cars or leaving lights on is becoming less socially acceptable. Now the feeling is growing that it's morally wrong to waste energy because of the pollution that it creates, he said.
And that was your News Jam. Well, thanks, chaps, for your Cockney words of wisdom. I'd be interested to explore a few of them. Ian, you are the bipedal man. Do you believe
the
all
original
this
bipedal man?
Do you believe that? I'm a bit sceptical myself.
It's a good question. So what these guys did was they observed, you know, basically a year of activity of orangutans in the treetops, and they said, well, because of the way these guys walk, it's possible that a common ancestor of all great apes actually learned how to do this in the trees. So when we came down, when the forest became more patchy and so on, we came down, we actually were pretty good at doing it already. And we just exploited that sort of thing already in our locomotive repertoire, whereas chimps and gorillas went on to learn how to knuckle walk as their own specialism. I don't think there's evidence in the sort of hard sense for this. I think it's
at the stage of a kind of interesting idea.
I think it's very speculative. I mean, the other guy, well, there are obviously the groups have all sorts of views on this, but one of the main guys is called Brian Richmond at George Washington University, and I chatted to him yesterday, and he was saying he thought this was an amazing study of orangutan behavior in the trees, but he said it doesn't really tell us, you can't know if that tells us much about our ancestry, because that really probably has to come from hardcore evidence from the fossil record.
And actually, you're the man with the smoking drug as well. Tell us.
No, well, I've certainly been looking into this one. It's quite interesting. It's the first pill to help people stop smoking that's been introduced in Britain, at least in the last 10 years. And it's sort of a 2 times a day, nearly £2 a day pill. And it works by mimicking nicotine in the brain. So what that does is it gives you actually a little dopamine high. Because it binds to those receptors, it also stops if you do go for a crafty fag while you're supposed to be quitting. The effect, the pleasurable effect of that, will be reduced, supposedly anyway. And they've found that, you know, it is helping people quit. But the people who do these studies, it's not a magic bullet. You've got to, you know, have an enormous amount of willpower and want to stop for that to work.
I mean, some people were arguing that paying for this for smokers to be able to give up is not a good idea. That's not the sort of thing we should be providing on the NHS. Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I was quite interested to listen to the arguments, because one of the big questions was, there are a number of other drugs for other conditions that aren't self-inflicted, which aren't available on the NHS and have been specifically stopped from being supplied to patients for free because they're too expensive. And the price differential isn't necessarily that great between this drug and those. And obviously, you know, you are a smoker, you choose to smoke at some point, even if, yes, you are horrendously addicted to it. But also, I think just the cost of, if you're trying to give up, actually the cost of this drug is probably less than the cost of your smoking habit. So I find it quite interesting that not only would the potential ex-smoker be given their drugs for free on the NHS, but they'd also save a few quid as well because they wouldn't be buying so many cigarettes.
They could probably save the NHS quite a lot of money as well, I suppose, in the long term, but yeah.
I wondered how if it's affecting the dopamine receptors, how you don't get as addicted to that drug as you do to cigarettes themselves.
That's a very good question.
Watch this space. Yeah, I mean, it might be. Absolutely.
Because that's the addictive property of nicotine, so, you know.
Yeah, you're going to have
an expensive habit, any way you look at it.
You can go and try that one out yourself, James, at some point, I think.
So we're going to have Champix junkies sort of wandering into their GP demanding more of it.
But it always happens, doesn't it? I mean, you have methadone addicts, you have Valium addicts, all of these things, mm-hmm, you know, pills for people to get off more serious problems.
Addictions are very difficult. Addiction is something very physiological, and it is. And nicotine is a drug, just like THC is a drug. And I think the fact that it's a legal drug shouldn't blind us to the fact that it is a drug.
What do you get if you cross a small village on the Welsh borders, a tent full of Guardian reading loveys, and a discussion about the Enlightenment featuring Steve Jones, Richard Dawkins and Martin Rees? The answer you're searching for, of course, is the Hay Festival's Guardian Science Experiment. Do you see what they did there? It's very clever. The panel were in severe danger, really, of agreeing wholeheartedly with each other for the entire thing, but there was one minor bust-up. Here's Martin Rees commenting first on the appliance of science.
Scientists don't have a better ethical sense than anyone else, and therefore it's crucially important that scientists should engage with the general public, media and political process in discussing how science should be applied, which doors that it allows us to open should be open and which left closed. Otherwise, the opinion polls in future will express to a greater concern. I think we scientists do have to engage with the wider public. In doing this, I think we need to have as many allies as we have. Although I agree almost completely with what's been said by the other two speakers, I would like to raise a point which I think will lead to a bit of disagreement with Richard, in that I'm going to say, in effect, that he should send Christmas cards to a few more archbishops on the grounds that if we give the impression that science is hostile to even the kind of mainstream religion that we have in this country, I think it'll be more difficult for us to combat the kind of anti-science sentiments that are really important. And I think that if we consider mainstream science, we could see it as an ally. In fact, Richard, in his talk yesterday, didn't say a word against the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was baffled by why he believed what he did, but he didn't say a word against him. And in fact, some archbishops are more scientific still. Archbishop Habgood, the former Archbishop of York, gave a talk at the British Association one year. And it was quite a good talk, but it led to a memorable headline in the paper the next day, which said, "Monkeys may have souls, says primate." So I think we should try and keep people like that on side as possible allies in dealing with extreme fundamentalism.
That was the Astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees, and here's our old friend, Professor Richard Dawkins.
Sending Christmas cards to archbishops, I'm delighted to do that, and some of my best friends are archbishops. I see the point Martin is making. I think you can argue it both ways. I have, in fact, allied myself with the recently retired Bishop of Oxford, Richard Harries, who is indeed a dear friend, in combating the subversion of scientific education which Sir Peter Vardy has been allowed to buy with his... remarkably little money. He only had to fork out £2 million. I mean, it's nothing to him in order to get £20 million of government money. Anyway, Bishop Harries and I have collaborated twice over efforts to do something about that. But I do think that you can make a slightly different case. I do think that if we are too friendly to nice, decent bishops, we run the risk of buying into the fiction that there's something virtuous about believing things because of faith rather than because of evidence. We run the risk of betraying the scientific enlightenment where we believe in evidence-based beliefs rather than beliefs that are insulated from criticism by being called faith. Bishops never kill anybody, but possibly they make the world safe for people who do kill people by glorifying and extolling the virtues of faith as opposed to reason and evidence.
That was Richard Dawkins taking part in the Guardian Science Experiment at the Hay Festival, incidentally chaired by yours truly. Sandy, bishops never kill people, but maybe they make the world a safer place for those people who do. Do you have any views?
Well, I think that one of the really important things that's different about science and religion is that science is based on evidence. And that was one of the great triumphs of the Enlightenment, was to establish an evidence-based science. And this is something, I mean, this is something that Linnaeus did in his first edition of his System of Nature. He had a category of animals that was called the paradoxa. And in there were things like the hydra and the dragon and the manticore and the, you know, automa mortis and the goose barnacle, which no one had ever seen. And so he had these there, and he didn't classify them in his system, but they kind of floated there in the middle. And by the fourth edition of the System of Nature, Systema Naturae, he started out the preface by saying, I personally have led my students through nature on wanderings to discover that which is true, and I will no longer accept things that I have not seen and are just the ravings of actors and the barkings of dogs. So he was explicitly saying that this is based entirely upon evidence, and I think that is something that's very, very important. And I think faith is faith. And as far as I'm concerned, people can believe what they would like. But science is about evidence.
Well, we have our own exclusive interviews with Richard Dawkins and Steve Jones, the third speaker in that debate. And in some future week, we'll also have Martin Rees's interview as well. They're on Science Extra this week. So all you need to do is go back to the blog or iTunes and look out for more. We have 188 friends on our MySpace page, and there are 50-plus members of our I Listen to the Guardian Science Podcast Network on Facebook, and we receive literally three emails a week, roughly. Yes, the web is a busy place at the best of times, but the past week was the busiest it's been for quite a while. Our man Bobby J has been spending his time staring at the blogs and telling us what's been happening. Bobby, what's going on?
Probably the biggest thing that happened in technology in the UK this week was Last FM, which is a web startup based in London, got sold to the American TV and radio network CBS for the grand total of $280 million, 140 million quid, which is not an insubstantial amount of money. It's one of the biggest web sales we've seen out of the UK for quite a long time. There's a lot of talk about the dot-com bubble coming back. But Last FM, which is a kind of a music recommendation engine, if you haven't used it, go online and have a look. Basically, what you do, you log on, you get an account. Every time you listen to music on your computer or your iPod or MP3 player, etc., it keeps a record of that. And it works out by comparing what you like to what other people are listening to. Music you haven't heard but would like. So it's really interesting.
Ben tells me it's called scrobbling.
Scrobbling, yeah. The act of noting down what you listen to.
What about these tabletop computers that Microsoft have been talking about? They seem like some kind of weird throwback to the 80s where you had, you know, Space Invaders in pub tables.
This is really interesting. I think I can't decide whether it's hype or really kind of really interesting stuff. But essentially it's a touchscreen tabletop computer that can take input from it's called multi-touch input, so you can put as many fingers as you like onto the table, or you can have many different people sitting around the table. And you could use it, for example, the way they've sold it in the first place is to things like hotels and casinos, and so, you know, you'll have a kind of virtual desktop space where you can move things around. But you can at the moment, you can do some interesting things like resizing photos or kind of manipulating documents. And when I was over at Microsoft HQ a couple of weeks ago, I saw this kind of technology. They've been touting it for a long time as a research thing. I saw it and, you know, I used it and it was really, really fancy. And then a week later, they go and release it to the general public for the grand sum of £10,000 a table.
Ooh.
Now, $10,000 a table. You know, I don't know at the moment whether that'll ever take off as a general thing. But I think it's really interesting, this whole kind of touch experience that you have with a computer. seems to be gaining a lot of currency. The iPhone, which everyone wet their pants about a few months ago, still hasn't arrived, but, you know, fingers crossed. That's got multi-touch on it as well, but on a very small screen. And there's some really interesting research going on in exactly these kind of areas. And, you know, we've been using computers with keyboards and mice and getting RSI for 25 years, and nobody's really challenged that way of doing things. But, you know, maybe in 10 years' time we'll all be using touchscreens as well.
Well, watch this space. Thanks, Bobby. Well, we're almost out of time again, but I just want to quickly bring in Sandy again. In terms of what's happening in taxonomy now, there's kind of a bit of a crisis in the field because there just aren't enough taxonomists. And we were also talking about David Attenborough. He's had something to say about this.
Well,
this week.
David Attenborough very, very kindly actually said that taxonomy was important to conservation in that you couldn't begin to conserve things that you, if you didn't know what they were, what there was in particular areas. And taxonomy was very unfashionable for a long time, and I think it's partly because people were perhaps forced to memorize long lists of names of things, and that's a bit dull in anybody's estimation. But one of the things is taxonomy is about whole organisms. And if you look at education at the university level in the UK, at least, is whole organism biology is on the decline. It's not just taxonomy. It's actually studies of whole organisms in their environments. Biology has become very, very molecular. Now, that's not bad. That's really very, very interesting. But what people are doing, and the thing I find fascinating about molecular biology today, is that it's exactly like what I do as a taxonomist. What people who study microRNAs, for example, do is they go into a genome, just like I go into the rainforest. They rummage around and find all kinds of stuff, just like I rummage around and find all kinds of plants and collect them. They bring them back. Some of them they know. They know what they do. They know what they're called. Other ones are new, just like taxonomy. So essentially, a lot of molecular biology is molecular natural history, which is great. It means we're discovering the world. It's almost as if you have nature in kind of a Perspex cube, and you look at it through each of the faces, and what we're finding is a new face to look at nature through. But we mustn't lose sight of the fact that what's in the cube are organisms which live in environments and evolve by natural selection.
Well, that be it, my lovelies. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, especially the God bit, because I know you're usually very reticent to come forward and talk about those kind of things, you can email us at science@guardian.co.uk or head to the blog or either of those aforementioned social networking sites. Perhaps you'd also like to investigate our archive too. There's lots of very good stuff in there, I can tell you. You'll find that at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. So my thanks as ever to Bobby Johnson and Ian Sample for making this such a splendid show, and to our special guest, Dr. Sandy Knapp from the Natural History Museum. Science Weekly's been produced by Ben Green, who's now off to play with his imaginary friends on Facebook. I've been James Randerson. I'm missing you already. Guardian Unlimited.